Talking History with Patrick Gagan. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auchtereuen, Argus.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're going in search of the judges in Ireland in the years before independence. We'll find out about a party like no other as we explore the history of the masquerade. And to end the show, the rise and fall of Japan's most controversial World War II general. And you can send us your thoughts and comments to talkinghistory@newstalk.com. And we begin tonight's show with the judges in Ireland. And a new book by Dara Hogan, which explores how the Irish judiciary changed in those crucial decades before Irish independence. The book is called The Judges of Ireland, 1866 to 1921. It's published in hardback by Four Courts Press in association or in partnership with the Irish Legal History Society. And Dara, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you, Patrick. Pleased to be here.
Can we begin with this crucial change that took place on New Year's Day in 1878? How did the judicial framework change? And why do you begin with this lead up to 1877, 1878?
Well, we're all familiar with the Four Courts as a building. It was built 1790s. There were literally not simply four separate court rooms. There were four separate court systems there. Hard to understand and rationalised in 1877, as I say, with effect from New Year's Day. It followed a similar rationalisation in England in 1873, so the change was coming. It was resisted by the bar, it was resisted by the senior judiciary, but the government knew better. And therefore, from 1877, we got a court system that we would recognise now, a high court and a single court of appeal as compared to the complicated systems there before. So it really set up a court system of a kind that we would recognise now. And what happened before that, even for lawyers or historians, if I may say so, is not at all as simple to understand.
Usually we have books that are maybe biographical studies of the judges, or we have studies of the institutions, but you actually do both. We get a sense of the people, the individuals and who they were, but we also get a very clear sense of the courts, of the institutions, on how they're emerging and changing as well.
Yes, well, like most people, you know, I would be interested in the individuals. That's where you begin, the human stories. And some of the individuals there whose names have come down to us, Christopher Pallas, Peter O'Brien, Peter the Packer, William Keogh, they're interesting people in themselves. They had interesting lives. But if, once you look at the judiciary as a whole, and there are about 80 people in the period that I cover, you have to understand the system to see how they fit into it and how it came together. And although it is an account of, as I say, some 80 individuals, some in more detail than others, there's lots of cross-references. They do intersect with each other. They complain about each other. They praise each other. And there's a human story behind the portraits and the sense of what judges do.
How did you become a judge in this period? Because I think merit was important, ability and character, but also you needed to, it seems, have other things, party service or parliamentary usefulness or some personal claim to it, that there was a lot of factors that were taken into account.
There were. You had to be a barrister. You had to be a man. If you were politically involved, this was extremely helpful. MPs, as you know, Patrick, weren't paid until 1911. Even when they were paid, they weren't paid huge amounts of money. But if you were a member of the bar, you stood probably at your own expense for election. You interrupted your legal career to go to London to attend the House of Commons. This created a great sense of entitlement. There was no retirement age for judges then. So if you had to wait for an appointment, a judge might die in office, a judge might ultimately retire. So there was quite strong competition for the positions as and when they became available. The bar was very aware of that, and the politicians were very aware of the power in their hands. And there was a kind of a tension between those and the judges. They were aware they were beholden to the prime ministers, to the politicians. Once they got there, they tended to be a bit more arrogant. And there was one man, Hugh Holmes, who was one of the MPs for Dublin University. He wrote a memoir. He said he was very disappointed by the calibre of the people that he met in the House of Commons. He thought they wouldn't earn a living in any other form of life, he thought. So there's an interesting tension between the position of the judiciary as one of the classical arms of government and the processes by which they ascended the judicial bench.
There are some major changes in the 1860s in terms of the judiciary itself changing, certainly the senior judiciary, and the government finding opportunities to reward some people. So there's a big turnover towards the end of that decade.
There is. There were about 20 senior judges at that time in the 30 months or so of Conservative rule between July 1866, December 1868, when Gladstone came in. There was a huge turnover. There was attention to it at the time because the Chief Justice of Queen's Bench was then aged 90, and he was clearly waiting for the government to change. It was the time of political instability in Britain. So there was a macabre incident in 1865 when he mispronounced a sentence of death at a murder trial, and the Attorney General had to go up on the bench beside him and kind of dictated to him. This was brought up in the House of Commons. They're trying to shame him into retiring, the Liberals, but it didn't work. He hung on, and the day after the Conservatives came in, he resigned. So this was quite a publicly known fact. Then there were a couple of, as it were, a couple of senior judges died at the time. So there was a huge turnover in those years. Although the structure and the system changes in New Year's Day 1878, you can see the winds of change coming from 1866, and some of the people who were prominent, either for good or for ill, in the reform process took office at that time in the 1860s.
It kind of reminds us of how it's done in the United States and how things can be very political and how you can wait a long time for the change that you might be looking for.
Indeed, and there is no great incentive to retire if you think you can retire at a strategic moment. I mentioned one case in 1890 when the Conservatives were in power. They wanted to find a place for the Attorney General, but they didn't want him to go just yet. So they asked one of the judges, a man called Chatterton, would he be prepared, in effect, to give them an undated letter of resignation? And he said no. So they said, well, very well, we'll just keep the position vacant until it is time to release the Attorney General. So there was a very heavy political aspect to that. Now, nationalist politicians obviously were by and large excluded from this process, and they complained quite bitterly about it. But it was well understood, I think, by all concerned in the Bar Library.
Let's talk about Gladstone then and his first government, because he seems to have introduced significant changes that this seems to be in a reform era. They wanted to balance legal ability with that political role, the claims of liberal lawyers and so on. And there are changes then.
There are. His Lord Chancellor, the one, as you know, the one legal position that is not held for life. The Lord Chancellor held office as long as the government did, and he resigned with them. He appointed Lord O'Hagan, the first Catholic Lord Chancellor for 150 years. One or two people were disappointed about that. They said, well, what does O'Hagan know about Chancery law? But it all sorted out. So you do get Gladstone's appointments in general. He took them seriously. So yes, he reformed various things in Ireland. He hoped to reduce the number of judges because there was a tension there. Government sought to reduce the number of judges. The Chief Justice said, well, we are not a division of the Treasury. We will conduct our judicial affairs as we see fit. And it's not that there's too many judges in Ireland. The comparison is that there aren't enough in England. So the legal system, the bar, the judicial system, they resisted quite a lot of the changes that came dropping slow.
Who were the judges who stand out for you, who you think were exceptional on the bench and who really are the significant figures in this period?
Well, Professor Niall Osborough, the guiding spirit of the Legal History Society, he had a lot of time for the judges of the 1880s, the 1890s. Gerald Fitzgibbon, whose portrait is on the cover, Hugh Holmes, Christopher Pallas. These were people who, the reality is, in the courts as they work now, more modern cases tend to be cited as authorities by barristers rather than the older cases. And obviously, laws and society change. But Fitzgibbon and Holmes and Pallas, they're names that will as judicial figures stand out. There's others, William Keogh or Peter O'Brien, who would stand out for their publicity they either attracted or generated. But those are the names that spring to mind. These are not, in general, household names. Maybe they will become so.
You write about there being a unionist monopoly and how unionists dominated judicial appointments and bench selection increasingly reflected unionist political control. What did that mean in terms of the implementation of the law and in terms of, I suppose, a sense that was this a just system and was justice, did justice prevail given that there was a very strong political bias?
That's an interesting point because there were 50 people who held office as Attorney General in the 19th century. 47 of these became judges. So nationalist politicians, including Tim Healy, they would say the government appoints people who are familiar with government ways of thinking. And so I think every judge would take an oath to, you know, do justice in a fair and proper manner. And no one disputes the good faith with which they took oaths. But if you were a land agitator or whatever, and you were faced with a judge, a court of three judges, all of whom had been unionist MPs, all of whom had been attorney generals, you might have thought, well, I hope they've remembered their judicial oaths today, because the popular perception was that justice was hard to find in the courts.
And even just a little bit before that, you see Gladstone in his second government trying to still, I think, reward political service, but also maintain public service in and public confidence in the system. And so there you see people appointed who perhaps are going to be publicly acceptable and maybe show that there is a kind of a new system in place.
There is, and Gladstone is conscious of the need to have a religious balance in that Lord Spencer, who was the Viceroy now at the time, he would have said to him, we do need a Catholic now today for this any particular vacancy. They were very conscious of that. People kept the score. And Gladstone in particular, when he was appointing a Lord Chancellor in 1882, there was a man called Sullivan who had been involved in his initial reforms, the disestablishment of the church, the Land Act of 1870. But his services were 10 years in the past. So he had another Attorney General who was much more involved in 1881 in the land war. And when Gladstone came to balancing these, he said he valued the more recent services more than the more historic services. So again, people who had expectations of appointment had to kind of keep their bakery fresh.
1906 seems to be an important turning point, and it seems up until then there weren't, it seems to me, very many Catholics or nationalists there. But then things start to change and the profile of the judges seems to change.
It does. The Irish Parliamentary Party members had a pledge not to accept office in any government except a Home Rule government. And apart from the fact that the unions were in office, which led to what I've called a unionist monopoly, nationalists weren't, in effect, eligible. So they called themselves liberals for the most part. Cherry, who was later the Lord Chief Justice, a great expert on the Land Acts, he said to John Redmond shortly before 1906, if I stood as an independent, would I have the support of the Parliamentary Party? And Redmond said, no, we could not support you unless you pledged not to accept office in that way. So I sometimes thought it, apart from the fact of the unionist monopoly, the fact that nationalists did not go forward for office or could not go forward under their own flag, it may have contributed to the perception later on, 1918, that nationalists really had nothing to offer or nothing to had not contributed anything significant to the judicial system.
The Judges of Ireland, 1866 to 1921. It's published in hardback by Four Courts Press, part of that Irish Legal History Society series. The author is Dara Hogan, and we'll be back with the history of the masquerade right after this. Welcome back, we're talking history, and now we're going to give you the first full history of an extraordinary 18th century British entertainment. Glittering masquerades held at the most fashionable London venues dominated the calendars of the Georgian elite. They were a thrilling opportunity to gather, flirt, and consume. And a new book brings together the story of the masquerade, an event which captivates us to this day. The book is called The Masquerade, A History of Extravagance and Intrigue. It's published in hardback by Yale University Press. The author is Megan Kobza. And Megan, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us about the masquerade. Tell us what it was, when was its heyday, and why was it such a cultural obsession?
That is a loaded question. Well, first of all, so this book takes place mostly in the 18th century. So we're looking at the 1700s. And my focus was on Britain. So most of the masquerades that I look at were in London. And the London masquerade is really unique because at the time, the masquerade in Europe more widely was something that was held within the courts, right, within the royal courts. And that meant that you had to be on the list to get in. You couldn't just be someone from off the street. The masquerades in London, you also couldn't just be someone off the street. However, they were ticketed. You could purchase a ticket to get into the entertainment. And this was new. And I think that's part of why there was in London sort of a big social anxiety about it, because it's not just an invitation list now. There is a ticket, there is a black market that you can, you know, some random person off the street can, if they have enough money, get access to the entertainment. And they're held mostly, at least for the first half of the century, in the Royal Opera House, in the King's Theater. And the origin of it, so back in the early 1700s, we have the ambassador of France, the Duc d'Aumont, come to some celebrations in London. He stays at Somerset House. They're celebrating a peace between England and France, which, you know, that relationship's a bit fraught and peace doesn't last too long. But he's there, he's celebrating, he wants to show off the French hospitality, and he ends up hosting one of the favorite French court entertainments, which is none other than the masquerade. So he hosts four of these in 1713, and the elite sort of pick up on this entertainment, which is then recognized by an impresario who becomes the manager of the King's Opera House, Johann Heidegger. And he's the one who brings the commercial ticketed masquerade into London. And the masquerade, you can sort of tell from its name, because it begins with mask, is all about disguising your face and disguising who you are. Now, whether or not that's actually effective is a completely different question. But the intention is that when you go to the masquerade, no one is supposed to know who you are. However, in 18th century London and in 18th century Britain and British culture, it's a culture of consumption. It's a culture of fashionability. It's a culture of taste. And the way that you establish your status is through your dress, is through your behavior, and is all about display. So even though you're supposed to be disguised, if you want to effectively show off your wealth, your status, your taste, you do need to be recognized, right? So there's this tension between spectacle, recognition, and anonymity. And the anonymity tends to sit more in the world of the imagined experience of the masquerade as opposed to the actual one. Because when you go, everyone actually figures out who everyone is pretty quickly.
And Heidegger is a fascinating figure, this Swiss emigre and impresario. And
yes.
And the chapter heading is called "He's the Ugliest Man in London." And it's really quite remarkable the way he's able to create and commercialize this and blend all the different elements to create something that people want to pay to go to.
Yes. Yeah. As a theater manager, he knows how to produce a really fantastic spectacle, right? I mean, operas today we see are so grand, and they weren't any different in the 18th century. So he's able to bring in those sort of theatrical skills and his theatrical flair to make this into a spot where his opera subscribers want to come. And then that in turn helps pay for his very expensive opera productions, because tickets in today's money, I know the correlations in pounds, because that's what I did in the book. For two guineas, they were about £450. And if people are going six times a year, and then you also have to pay for a costume, and you also have to pay for your transportation, like the tickets get pretty expensive pretty quickly. And it's more about spending power, really, than it is the dry conversion back and forth with the inflation calculator. The average person in the 18th century would never have been able to afford to go to a masquerade. So in today's money, £400-450 is not an unreasonable amount of money to commit to something. Thinking about like Taylor Swift Eras Tour, right? But people would save up to go to that. And yes, you could have done that in the 18th century, but you also had to be on the subscription list. So even if you could have afforded that baseline 2 guinea ticket price, you still had to be sort of socially vetted on a subscription list.
Scandal and controversy becomes associated with the masquerades from a fairly early stage. How did they become such a source of controversy? And why was there such concern about sin and depravity?
Yeah, so this is really interesting because the court mask was part of royal culture, I mean, since the Tudors, really, with and then up through the Stuarts with Inigo Jones and putting on these grand sort of allegorical productions within the court. And you had fancy dress coming in and, you know, all sorts of, again, outrageous spectacle. So there is a recognition of some semblance of what the masquerade is, but it's coming from France and it has roots in Italy and these are foreign places. And there's a lot of anxiety about Catholicism. There's a lot of anxiety about not favoring British taste and favoring the Italian style over the British style. So Hogarth is actually one of the people who's pretty pivotal in this, I guess, mockery or concern of the masquerade when he produces in 1724, masquerades and operas, a bad taste of the town. And he just sort of like pillories Heidegger and the masquerades. He does it again in 1727. And part of that is because it's not favoring British talent, whether that's on the stage or whether that's in art. And then we see that also picked up in literature and this concern. And it's mostly men who are concerned about the masquerade. We see that picked up in Henry Fielding's literature, in his novels that he's writing. And this fear in the Bishop of London, who, you know, writes sermons about it, that the masquerade is allowing the top 1% to play with social structure and play with their roles in society. And so they are setting a bad example for everyone else. And that's their concern, is that then if the upper group is setting this bad example of being topsy-turvy, it's going to trickle down to everyone else. And the whole world is just going to flip on its head, which is not what happened, as we well know. But it was this concern and the idea of what are women doing at these entertainments? And there's always questions about how transgressive the masquerade was. And yes, great, people were able to experiment with gender in the way that they dressed and the way that they performed their characters at the masquerade. They were also doing that with race and ethnicity. So we see as Britain is expanding with the empire, they're encountering different types of people. And those people, unfortunately, are being represented in rather harmful ways at the masquerade. So thinking about Afro-Caribbean people, thinking about Indian people, and the ways that they're caricatured at the masquerade. And then that feeds into wider culture. So yes, transgressive, because people get to experiment with these different, quote, character types. But if it's only the top 1% who gets to do it, how transgressive is it actually? So it's a very interesting, I guess, question to think about as far as this hyped up scandal that, you know, leading cultural figures, or at least a small selection of them, were touting at the time.
Some remarkable women and some remarkable characters in the book. And there's one woman, Elizabeth Chudley, and some of the outfits that she wears are quite imaginative and interesting. And her whole life and career is fascinating.
Yeah, so Elizabeth Chudley, the only masquerade that we know for sure that she went to, I think there's two for sure, in 1749. And so at that time, she had a clandestine secret marriage to Augustus Harvey. And she was the maid of honor to the sitting Princess of Wales, Princess Augusta. And the only condition for being a maid of honor is that you are not married. And here's Elizabeth Chudley in this secret marriage. And so Elizabeth Chudley is concerned that her marriage is going to get out. And it's not going well with Harvey in the first place. And so she's nervous she's going to lose her position, that he's going to leak it or someone else is going to leak it, because not many people knew about it, but there's still always, you know, how many people can keep a secret sort of a thing. And things are not looking great for her. She's getting older. You know, she's in her late 20s. She's getting nervous about what's going to happen financially to her in the future. She can only be maid of honor for so long before people are like, right, it's time to bring in someone else. And so she decides to sort of step out at the masquerade at King's Theater in 1749. And in the 18th century, most people at the masquerade would have been very familiar with the costume she chose. And I'll explain what that is in a minute, because it's from antiquity. It's from the story of Troy, when King Agamemnon is going out to Troy with the boys and they can't get their ships out of the harbor. And so the gods say, you need to sacrifice your daughter to get the winds to cooperate and send you out. So he grabs his daughter, Iphigenia, and she is a famous figure. She's in paintings and she's in statues. And the depiction is that she is there bare-breasted, giving herself over, trusting her father. And then he, you know, sacrifices her to the gods. So that is the image of Iphigenia, is that famous sort of chest exposed, trusting her father to be betrayed, basically. And that's what Elizabeth Chudleigh decides to go as. It is extremely bold. Whether or not she actually went full, like, boobs out, we don't know for sure. But there was definitely the illusion of nudity, if not nudity itself. And it's fascinating because, so in the book, I think there's six different images of her, because every person depicts her slightly different from another person. So we don't know which one is real or if they're all a little bit real, but in all of them, you can see her top half pretty clearly. And when she goes into the masquerade, she's taking a huge risk. She's either going to completely destroy her reputation or she's going to become an overnight sensation. And of course, she has no idea. Hopefully it's the latter, but she has no idea when she goes in. And there's different accounts. So Horace Walpole talks about her. Lady Montague talks about her. So, like, she appears in people's correspondence and diaries, and she appears in print culture. And this label of Iphigenia sticks with her for the rest of her life and sort of cements her to the masquerade. And when she goes in, she's there for a bit, and Augusta is there, and she sort of, like, sidles over to Elizabeth and is like, here's a shawl, let's cover you up. And Elizabeth's like, just, you know, sort of politely shrugs it away. No, thank you, I'm good. And much to Elizabeth's luck, George II, who's king at the time, finds her and is just, he cannot get enough. He's a bit of a lech anyway, but she sort of ends up becoming one of his unofficial mistresses and climbs the social ladder, which is exactly what she was hoping for. She gets into his top circles, and that's where she ends up meeting her future second husband and eventually getting the title the Bigamist Duchess. So her costume is fascinating, her story even more so, but it does go to that sort of transgressive nature of the masquerade, especially for women, because women were the ones who really took the liberties to sort of go over the top with how they presented themselves, whether that was through wearing tens of thousands of pounds worth of diamonds or not much at all in the case of Elizabeth Chudleigh.
What I love about the book is that you show this isn't just harmless entertainment. Actually, there's an awful lot going here in terms of who's taking part, and that beneath the glamour, there's issues there about class and empire and gender and race and power. So that it's actually a very important, a very interesting way and a very significant way of getting our insights into this world of the 18th century.
Yeah, I would say it's sort of a cultural zeitgeist, where you get to see the different things that are popping up at the time. So we have people who dress in costumes that are inspired by theater. We have people who dress in really boring things like the domino, which is just like a basic cloak that you could jazz up if you wanted to, but you just put it over what you were wearing that day. But we do see with empire, and this is what I thought was so fascinating, again, about this sort of like transgressive, everyone gets to go, everyone gets to do whatever they want. It's not the case, because the people who are being caricatured, so for example, Afro-Caribbean people were not generally going to masquerades, or Indian people were not generally going to masquerades. It is that top group, and who is, you know, 99.9% white landed gentry, nobility, aristocracy, lots of money coming in, mostly money from colonial wealth. There's lots of ties to that that are in chapter 5 and chapter 9 in the book that sort of talk about that, because we need to think about where the money is coming from that's funding these entertainments, perhaps not the commercial ones, because Heidegger, the tickets are sort of paying for it, but the what's funding the private ones that are held at country houses, what's funding the outfits that people are wearing and allowing them to go. And the while this sort of like elite group could dress across race and gender, people of color were not allowed that same privilege. They generally had to dress more horizontally speaking. So we have Mai, who is a Pacific Islander who goes to some masquerades, and he only ever dresses as other indigenous characters or in a domino. So he doesn't climb the social ladder to move up. He doesn't go with Henry VIII, right? Or there's another instance, which is not in the book, Joseph Brandt, whose Native American name is Tyandanegea, and he goes to a masquerade dressed in his Mohawk ceremonial dress. So, I mean, you know, of the extensive, like 3,000 newspapers I've looked through and diaries and everything, that's what I've seen. It's a very interesting way to look at the wider picture of what the 18th century world was, at least in the British sense.
If you had a time machine and was able to go back to the world of the masquerades and you attended one, do you think you would be horrified by the vulgarity and what was on show? Or do you think you'd have the best night of your life seeing all of this in reality? Or how do you think you would react to it?
Yeah, I think it would be a mixed bag. I think it would be a little bit of both, which is not unlike actually one of the characters. I call them characters. They're all real people. But in the book, Agneta York goes to a masquerade and is like, this was the worst choice of my life. Because you hype yourself up and then you go and you're like, oh, this was not the night out I imagined. So I think if I could go, I would love to soak in the sensory experience of it, like the sounds and the smells, which would probably not be very pleasant, but like seeing what the foods are that are on display, because while you get descriptions of them, it's completely different to be in the room as opposed to reading about the room, and to see all of the dresses would, I think, be pretty incredible. But yes, I also think I'd be like, oh my God, I cannot believe that, you know, seeing blackface costumes, for example, or brownface. That would be a little skin crawly for me. But to see some of the other costumes, the Minervas, the Dianas, the Harlequins, the even the dominoes in action would be pretty cool. So I do think I would probably enjoy it more than I would cringe at it, just because it's something that I've worked on for so long, that to be able to experience it would be pretty incredible.
Well, it's called The Masquerade, A History of Extravagance and Intrigue. It's published in hardback by Yale University Press. The author is Megan Kobza. And Megan, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you. It was absolutely delightful.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this, as we find out about General Tojo and Japan and the Second World War. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're Talking History. The military general who became Emperor Hirohito's prime minister, Hideki Tojo, is most often remembered as an iron-fisted leader who dragged Japan into World War II and, after spectacular losses, was eventually executed as a war criminal. Yet Tojo was far more than his ignominious end. And in fact, as a new book argues, he was one of the 20th century's most accomplished military statesmen. The book is called Tojo, The Rise and Fall of Japan's Most Controversial World War II General. The book is published in hardback by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. The author is Peter Moak. And Peter, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Patrick.
Can we start with that big question about Tojo and the controversy around him? And for some, he was seen as Japan's Hitler. For some, he was blamed for everything to do with Japan entering the Second World War and their leadership there. But it's a more nuanced portrait of him that we see here.
So within Japan and outside of Japan, you are correct. He is viewed in fairly simplistic terms, as a dictator, as maybe Japan's answer, as you say, to Hitler or perhaps Stalin. Certainly he's seen as the one who dragged Japan into World War II. These are rather cartoonish. I mean, there's an element of truth, perhaps, to some of these images. And yet, he was a vastly more complex figure than those cartoonish images suggest. And he also operated in a very complex bureaucratic structure that also defies easy characterization and also mitigated against these simple sort of or mitigated against the possibility, for example, that a real dictator could arise in pre-surrender Japan.
He had a strategic vision. He had a coherent vision. It just wasn't a successful vision. And his ambitions and his plans, despite him being this tactical genius and despite him having all of these insights, it ended up completely unraveling for him.
Yes, indeed. He had a vision, whether it was a vision that had any appeal outside of the ranks of the Japanese army, I think is open to question, because in essence, he arose within an army that prioritized the infantry. He rose within an army that prioritized the idea of a decisive battle. But then he also, running in slightly different directions, he studied quite intensively the impact of World War I on the German military and ultimately on the German state. And so this opened his eyes to questions of total war and how Japan basically had him thinking very carefully about how Japan should prepare for the next war. And this ultimately led him it led him to a vision whereby effectively the state, the Japanese state, in his vision at least, was to a greater or lesser extent subordinated to the strategic needs of the military. And that ultimately meant aggression abroad. And at home, it meant that he really stifled debate within Japan and discussion within Japan so that he never imposed martial law, but he turned the screws decidedly in that direction so that it left... there were very few in Japan, I think, who lamented his loss of power when he did lose power in mid-1944.
You have an absolutely brilliant description of him in near the start of the book. You describe him as the apex political predator in wartime Japanese politics. And then you go on to say that, stated simply, Tojo was the single most accomplished political operator in Tokyo's halls of power during the first two decades of Hirohito's reign from 1926 to 1945. So what made him so successful? What made him the single most accomplished political operator?
Great question. Not an easy answer. He rose up the ranks of a Japanese army, which, although most professional military men would have balked at the title or at the suggestion that the army was politicized, it was, in fact, a highly politicized force. And without going into all the details, that politicization within the military ultimately led to factions, and those factions found themselves in, well, at first bruising factional warfare, which ultimately became murderous. He navigated these very, very difficult and tricky factional politics within the army. So that in effect, it spawned within him it made him very much a political operator, so that once he, for example, was appointed to a ministerial position, he didn't come in as a complete greenhorn. He came in as a real political operator. Again, I don't think he would have welcomed that term, but he entered a cabinet or took a cabinet position with real political runs on the board, as it were. And so he also then had the immense institutional power of the army. So you bring these two things together. Once he's on cabinet, he had this immense institutional backing, but he also had this finely tuned political instinct. And of course, during his time on cabinet, he honed that political ability further and further until he really was, until battlefield losses just piled up one after the other in the Pacific and rendered his position untenable. Until that point, he was more or less untouchable politically.
And I think it's brilliant the way you explore and tease out the relationship with the emperor. And, you know, it's a much more nuanced relationship than Hirohito being a simple puppet or Hirohito being the villain. That it, there's a very interesting dynamic between the two of them, and they each have their own visions, but then they find ways of accommodating each other.
Yes, very much so. Very much so. So they most certainly did not see eye to eye. Tojo was, for one thing, he was extraordinarily deferential to the emperor. So, for example, on the eve of his prime ministerial appointment, he stated boldly to his professional military colleagues that if the emperor, he was anticipating an audience in the imperial palace, and he said to his colleagues, well, if the emperor tells me right now that we have to withdraw all troops from China, he said, I will not argue that point, and we will, the army will withdraw all troops from China. So he meant that. He very much meant that. The emperor, however, did not, was insistent that he did not rule by decree. He was not an autocrat. And so what we find is this, over time, is an incredibly symbiotic relationship where, maybe to symbolize the relationship, there's an imperial rescript which dates back to the late 1800s, which describes soldiers and sailors as the emperor's limbs. And that, I think, is just such a wonderful... Tojo very much took that to heart, and he saw himself as the emperor's legs, effectively. So what this meant was, in practice, he would do all of the legwork. He would work very, very hard at forging a consensus among, say, ministers and various others in the halls of power, but he would forge this consensus in ways that were broadly within his own vision. He could then take that to the emperor, and the emperor was a man who insisted on due process. And Tojo had, by forging a consensus in the halls of power in Tokyo, this is precisely what he was feeding the emperor. But he was feeding him, in so doing, he was at the same time, he was sort of bending things to his own will. So there's this an incredibly complex and incredibly nuanced relationship playing out between the two men.
I was astonished to discover that Tojo himself only discovered that the Navy had an attack plan for Pearl Harbor. And he learned this only days before it was launched. And he learned it not because he was the prime minister, but because he was a general serving as army minister. And that just seems, you know, completely bizarre that he wouldn't be directly in the loop or directly planning things.
At one level, it does seem bizarre, but in the context of the ways in which the Japanese operated, it made perfect sense, because this was the Pearl Harbor attack was the Navy's or a naval operational plan, and the Navy saw no particular need to share its operational plans with anyone, frankly, outside of the Navy. And so not until early December, so literally less than a week before Pearl Harbor, Tojo, as you say, was invited to a meeting of Imperial General Headquarters, which brought together both the Army and the Navy's top brass. And it was at this point, and he was invited himself, as you suggest, as an Army General, not as Prime Minister. So he hears this plan and he walks out thinking to himself that, okay, so as Prime Minister, I actually don't know this. It's only as Army Minister that I've that I am privy to this privileged information. And therefore, he engaged in this incredibly complex interior dance almost, where Army Minister Tojo was keeping or had to withhold information that he knew from Prime Minister Tojo, which sounds completely wild, and Tojo himself admitted this. When he the moment he learned of the Pearl Harbor attack plane, he actually muttered to himself and said, how can I possibly conduct a war in these kinds of conditions where, again, where the two armed services are simply not sharing rather important secrets with each other?
He goes from this triumphant total warrior after initial battlefield successes in the opening months of the Pacific War to then becoming a troublemaker because he's clashing with so many different elements, and there's all of these conflicts. And then what was his, I think, brilliant strategic ability seems to calcify, and he becomes a bit rigid and inflexible. And it's very much a case that as the war goes on, he becomes less effective, and confidence in his abilities, both military and political, seem to ebb away as well.
Most certainly. Well, certainly confidence in his abilities, maybe he didn't lose a lot of his own, he didn't lose confidence in his own abilities. And for that very reason, in fact, he took on multiple ministerial posts, including not just prime minister and army minister, but he served at various times as foreign minister, as munitions minister, as various other various ministerial posts. But ultimately, he also took on the post of army chief of staff, and that one was arguably unconstitutional, and it actually created a backlash of opposition even from within the army, which really started pushing back quite hard against him for having done this. So he himself maintained an absolute confidence in his own abilities and skills. But in the process, of course, he made himself so busy that it became difficult for him to stay on top of things, essentially, and also to communicate properly with his subordinates in the various ministries and in the general staff. He became somewhat aloof, I think. And so that started to create, or we see as a result of this, that confidence from below, from among his subordinates, that starts to erode. And at the same time, of course, well, ultimately, battlefield loss after battlefield loss after battlefield loss has others, not just his subordinates, but, for example, his ministerial counterparts. And ultimately, the emperor himself is beginning to look at Torjor through, or is beginning to see that he actually doesn't have a lot of answers anymore. The problem was that nor did anybody else. And so he remained in power for longer than perhaps he might have. But again, that owed at least in part to the emperor's concern that, even if we remove him from the halls of power, then what can the next guy possibly do different? Which is to say that ultimately Japan at that point, by let's say early 1944, was in a real bind and there was no easy way out.
And the island of Saipan features in Irish World Cup history, and it features in the fall of Tojo as well, because when Saipan is captured, that really is the end of him, and he's forced to resign. But you have a fascinating chapter on what happens next and the way he acts to shield the emperor, to take responsibility and represent Japan's interests even out of power.
Yes, I think in his own way, he believed he was representing Japan's best interests. He believed he was protecting the emperor from possible prosecution as a war crimes suspect. That's not to downplay the war crimes he was found guilty of, and he himself accepted full responsibility, having sat atop the military chain of command for a period of years. He accepted, on those grounds, accepted full responsibility for any war crimes that had happened out on the battlefield.
And he was found guilty, sentenced to death.
Yes, he was. And again, he himself believed, probably quite rightly, that before the trial had begun, that effectively he was a dead man walking, that the trial would find him guilty. He saw no other possible outcome. It signals his own acceptance in a court of law of real war crimes. Even though, on the other hand, he ferociously denied and pushed back as hard as he possibly could against the other charge, which was that he had committed so-called crimes against the peace. With that, he took very, very strong issue and very powerful issue. Again, readers may disagree with the positions he staked out, but he made quite a coherent case against the charge of crimes against the peace. In that way, he effectively defended Japan's actions. Whether they were defensible or not is another matter altogether, but he certainly, in a way, stood up for Japan at a point in time when, frankly, nobody else was doing it. So this created a really interesting dynamic within Japan itself. So he had been desperately unpopular in Japan for quite some time now. In fact, he'd been, by the time he was removed from power in July 44, he was so unpopular that he had a round-the-clock military police surveillance of his home to ensure that assassins, etc., didn't come after him. And he remained desperately unpopular after surrender, continued to receive mountains of hate mail from folks all over Japan. And then just for this one moment, after he took the stand and again, really very, very ferociously defended Japan against these various charges, for this briefest of moments, he rose once again in popularity within Japan, where everybody was suddenly, they felt a little energized, where Japan had gone from being beaten and downtrodden. And suddenly, just for this brief moment, there's this, everybody kind of, it gave everyone a kind of a shot in the arm almost, as it were. It didn't last. He went back to becoming public enemy number one in a very, very short space of time.
The book is called Tojo, The Rise and Fall of Japan's Most Controversial World War II General. The book is published in hardback by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. The author is Peter Moak. And Peter, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much for having me, Patrick.
Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Maurice O'Sullivan, for bringing everything together. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so I hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.